Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion on the impact on Australia of the global financial crisis. We have two very well-known journalists who are also authors, and David Urin and Lenore Taylor, and they're here on the occasion of the publication by MUP of Shitstorm, Inside Labor's Darkest Days. Now, I'll introduce our speakers briefly. We'll start with Lenore Taylor, we'll go to David Urin, and then we'll go to questions and discussion. Janet Grundy has got copies of the book here, and I'm sure our authors would be happy to sign it. I'll be very brief. Lenore Taylor is an award-winning political journalist who has covered federal politics for 22 years, and she's the national affairs correspondent for the Sydney Morning Herald, a regular commentator on radio and television, and of course appears on the ABC Insiders program. David Urin covered the global financial crisis as the economics correspondent for The Australian. He has 35 years of experience in economics journalism and has been working from the Canberra Press Gallery for The Australian since 2004. So we'll start off with Lenore. We'll go to David for questions, discussion. Lenore, thank you.
Thanks very much. When Kevin Rudd, the former Prime Minister, launched our book, Shitstorm, astonishingly, it was only 1 month ago, it seems like a lot longer ago than that, he, in his speech, made the case that Australia's successful weathering of the global economic crisis meant that we, unlike countries overseas, were not talking about rising unemployment, we were not talking about an unsustainable level of debt, but we were getting on with talking about health and education and what to do with the proceeds of the mining boom. We're able to get on with these debates because we're not facing years of recovery from recession, he said. For his own part, he was clearly breathing a sigh of relief a little bit too soon. He lost his job just 3 days later. But we argue in the book that despite the Rudd government's comparative success in steering Australia through the crisis, the seeds of most of its current political problems were also sown during that time. Most obviously, there were the mistakes that were made during the second stimulus package, particularly in the design of the $3.8 billion pink-backed program and the $16.2 billion Building the Education Revolution program. But second, we also argue that the economic crisis contributed to the sequence of events that led to the collapse of the government's climate change policies and the way that the Rudd government then mishandled that, and that had a lot to do with the demise of Kevin Rudd. And third, we argue that the crisis allowed Kevin Rudd to continue with a way of doing business, an administrative structure that the centralisation of power, the sidelining of cabinet, the personal involvement in decision-making to a dysfunctional extent, for longer than he would have otherwise been able to. And the resentment in the cabinet and in the party built up and built up when his high levels of personal popularity amongst the voters fell away. There wasn't that support base within the party left. And I think the crisis continued that decision-making for longer than would have otherwise been the case. So on the first point, it was instructive when we went back and we talked to all the members of the Kitchen Cabinet, the Strategic Priorities and Budget Committee, which really made most of the decisions in the Rudd government years, about the atmosphere that was there when they were taking those decisions in late 2008 and early 2009, that they had realised in the late 2008 that they would probably have to act again in early 2009. And they had realised that that would probably mean they had to take the budget into deficit. And for a Labor government, that was a pretty big thing to do. They had a lot of history in that regard. It was a difficult admission. And you remember back at that point, they were going through that amazing verbal gymnastics about not using the D word. But in the end, they decided, they made a quite explicit decision that the political ramifications of rising unemployment would be far greater than the ramifications of allowing the government, the budget, to go back into deficit. And it was really unemployment that was preoccupying them when they were designing that second package. They wanted spending ideas that would create jobs. They wanted to know, and the Prime Minister in particular, the then Prime Minister in particular, wanted to know where the jobs would be created, in what geographic locations and in what sectors of the economy. And the policies were really chosen to that end. The advisers, for example, with the Pink Bats program, it was chosen because it could employ low-skilled people with minimal training. But advisers originally proposed a tax rebate so that householders could claim back some of the cost of installing their insulation. That was rejected by the SPBC because it wouldn't, they thought, result in a fast enough take-up. The Department of the Environment proposed originally a sort of a top-down approach where the program was put out to a couple of big companies for tender. That was rejected because it was feared that the jobs might not spread out through the economy far enough. So the ultimate decision, which proved a fateful decision, was to design a scheme that effectively allowed most households to get insulation for free from scores of small suppliers. And that obviously paved the way for disaster, and unethical operators sprang up. The industry multiplied to 20 times its original size in the space of just 1 year, and it completely overwhelmed the piecemeal federal and state regulations and efforts at auditing. We ponder in the book whether someone might have spotted the obvious design flaw in that scheme if it had actually gone to the broader cabinet for decision making, where there were many ministers with more experience in actual service delivery than in the kitchen cabinet. We were also astonished to learn that the second package was not designed with a total spending figure in mind. It was constructed in order to get the outcome that the government wanted in terms of job creation. The Prime Minister was really totally preoccupied, everyone told us, with how many jobs each measure would create and how that would measure against the damage to employment that was being predicted by the Treasury. So the ultimate figure of $42 billion for that package sort of emerged a bit like the supercomputer in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which spat out 42 as the meaning of life. It was the answer that created the right number of jobs, not a number that was chosen because it made up for a collapse in private sector demand, which was how the total spending figure in the first stimulus package was chosen. On the second point that I mentioned at the beginning, the emissions trading scheme, it's interesting to remember that the crucial original decisions on scheme design, on the ETS scheme design, were made in late 2008, in those same months when the government was first looking at the global crisis and confronting that economic issue. And it was during that time that the resource and the economic ministers won some quite critical battles in the cabinet subcommittee that dealt with that issue. They won in particular the battle about how the government intended to try to get the ETS through the Senate, and that would only be with the support of the coalition, who, it must be said, at that time did have an emissions trading scheme as its policy. But there was an explicit decision that they would not try to pitch a scheme that could be used, that could go either way in the Senate, that could be either maybe amended to win the support of the coalition or perhaps the support of the independents and the Greens. Now, it's true that the Green independent route had a lot of other difficulties, and it's hard to tell what would have happened had that option been left open. But at that stage, we should remember, it wasn't yet clear that Victorian Family First Senator Steve Fielding would emerge as an avowed climate sceptic. And if you look at how he's acted in the Senate, it's usually with an eye on dealing himself into decision-making. So I think there's at least a chance that he might have emerged as the person trying to broker amendments to maybe protect family electricity bills or whatever in a package that went the other way. Anyway, those decisions, I think, locked the government into coalition support and left it vulnerable to the politics of what eventually happened. I would argue it also strengthened the hands of those within the coalition who were opposed to Malcolm Turnbull's proposed course of action of doing a deal with the government on the ETS. So we do argue that the backdrop of the crisis contributed to the ETS, which was a big part of the government's political concerns. And on the third point, we argue that the crisis allowed Kevin Rudd's decision-making style, which Robert Ray has described as a Nelson's Column system of government. It's not like John Howard had a pyramid. This is like a Nelson's Column with Rudd on top and, you know, nobody else below. And that continued for longer because of the crisis, because the crisis could be used to justify extreme secrecy and to justify the need for speed. So that, for instance, the full cabinet only saw the content of that first stimulus package after all the press releases were already typed up and ready to go. I'm sure that after the election, more stories will emerge about the sort of dysfunctionality of the Rudd office. But already ministers, even ministers who are very supportive of Rudd's direction, of his policy ideas, talk about endless meetings of the SPBC from which no decision emerged, which were left to the Prime Minister to then consider and come up with a final position. And that took forever and ever. And certainly when I went back to look at the decision to delay the emissions trading scheme, and it was sort of from that point that Kevin Rudd's personal popularity really began to plummet, that was the picture that emerged. Endless discussion and endless debate, but then no decision until it was a crisis and a decision was forced on them. Now, I really do think that had the government not had the sort of middle 18 months of its term taken up with crisis management effectively, those kind of problems would probably have been ironed out a lot earlier. There would have been ministers who would have said, you know, really this has to stop. One of the things we also discovered in researching the book was that the Treasury had conducted some secret workshops back in 2004, so right at the height of the boom years, on how it should advise a future government who was facing the prospect of a recession, what policy advice the Treasury should give. The Treasury had felt it had been largely out of the loop in the decision-making on the policy response in the 1990s recession, and they wanted to make sure that that didn't happen again. And they came away from those workshops with the advice that they did give to the Rudd government about going very hard, going very quickly, and directing money to households. They were clear that the big infrastructure projects that the Keating government had tried to fund were too slow and that the money would come into the economy too late to really be of assistance in stimulating the economy. In fact, it came into the economy when it was already growing again strongly. It was actually more of a hindrance in economic terms. I think if they were to hold a workshop in the next couple of years and look back at this crisis, they would need to come up with some other advice about the design and policy implications of those sort of middle type of infrastructure programs, like the pink bats and like the school halls. Possibly advice about how much money you can practically spend in a very limited period of time, and certainly advice on how you administer it or properly administer things with the states. The political price of steering the nation through the recession has been very high, and as we follow the decision-making through the book, that is quite clear. It's been high for Labor, and I think that it's setting the tone of this election campaign, and it was certainly higher for Kevin Rudd than he ever imagined. I think when he said that on television last month, March, that he was facing a political shitstorm, he really didn't know the half of it.
Part two. One of the more poignant lines in hindsight in Kevin Rudd's launch of our book was his lament that, quote, perhaps the government has suffered politically because we acted so quickly that many Australians today aren't even aware of the threat we faced. And he cited our comment from the book that, quote, Australia bore the recession very lightly. The reality is that people only factor in what they know. Those whose jobs were saved don't know who they are, and even if they did, they'd be hard-pressed to, in most cases, to draw the link between their retaining their jobs and the government's actions. So the government's fighting this election, at least in part, on its economic record. Its view is that its actions through the global financial crisis, which dominated its agenda through 2008-09, saved Australia from sharing the fate of the rest of the advanced world. I thought it would be worth just looking at, I guess, our take at the end of having written this book of, well, what was the government's contribution to Australia's good fortune, and you know, to what extent is it hyperbole, and to what extent really, you know, does the opposition have a point? So Wayne Swan's view is that voters do have some awareness of the difference between Australia's experience of the downturn and the experience of other advanced countries. And he believes that voters will give the government some credit for its economic management. The coalition, by contrast, has really whitewashed the global financial crisis. It's kind of as though it didn't really happen. It is working very hard to characterise the this Labor government as one in a long history of big spending Labor governments that, you know, can't be trusted with the public purse and is leaving a legacy of debt. Our conclusion is that the government did make a difference, and that the resulting debt, certainly by any kind of international benchmark, is laughably small. $100 billion, I know, but really, by international benchmark, laughably small. We're also persuaded that the government spent far more than it really needed to. And that's not just a hindsight judgment. Malcolm Turnbull articulated it well at the time. As Coalition Treasury spokesman Joe Hockey has commented, Australia's good fortune had many fathers. The government's finances were in great shape going into the crisis. The Reserve Bank's actions, cutting interest rates very aggressively, brought an immediate relief to both people with mortgages and businesses. The precipitate fall in the currency also helped domestic manufacturers and exporters. The commodity boom, which had been running full bore through to 2008, meant that Australia entered the downturn with the momentum of record levels of business investment. Australia's banks were in good shape, with little exposure to the toxic assets that sent so many of the world's financial powerhouses to the wall. Hockey acknowledges that the government stimulus spending played a part. Throw enough money at a problem, he says, and some of it will get spent. Another source of stimulus which Hockey doesn't mention, but which I think is of relevance, is the record rate of immigration. On a per capita basis, Australia did suffer a recession. However, population growth helped firms to maintain sales and staff. It's when layoffs start dominating the headlines that households start getting nervous about spending, and a vicious circle develops. Well, there's no way of really apportioning the credit, but I think there are enough pointers to, on an anecdotal basis, to at least draw some tentative conclusions. The power of fiscal policy, of budget spending, to shape economic outcomes has had a long and controversial history. Through the 1950s and 60s, it was paramount in Treasury thinking that government spending was really the way to control the economy. But it steadily lost favour through the 70s as it became apparent that simultaneous inflation and economic stagnation meant that people lost faith in the power of deficit spending to really help very much. There have been plenty of academic arguments that say that fiscal stimulus cannot work. Locally, economists such as Tony Macon, Henry Ergus and Sinclair Davidson have all advocated these throughout the crisis. But in the lead up to the crisis, the major reservations of Treasury were more of a practical nature. It was, can you actually get the money to the point where it matters sufficiently quickly, given the lugubrious pace of parliamentary politics? Well, the cash splashes under the first and second stimulus packages were controversial. I loved the headline from the Daily Telegraph, "Grateful Dead Get a Rise from Kev." And so it was a description of the reported stimulus payments to 17,000 deceased estates. Alan Jones fulminated about rapists and murderers receiving government checks in prison. And even some of the retailers were doubtful. Jerry Harvey from Harvey Norman around Christmas 2008 was suggesting that a lot of the money had been saved. Malcolm Turnbull scored political points with his lines about this was just a sugar hit. Well, perhaps it's just my Protestant soul, but I think that there's something about the government giving away money that struck many people as wrong. The polling by early 2009 was showing that it was not winning the government political points. But from it was striking that from a meeting of the Strategic Priorities and Budget Committee, the Kitchen Cabinet, on the 11th and 12th of October, it took just 6 weeks to get cheques into people's hands. In December of 2008, you'll remember, was a dark time. Share prices were down by more than 40%. House prices were also starting to fall, with some suggesting they'd follow the United States experience of 20, 30, 40% drops. World trade had plunged an unthinkable 25%. Early hopes that Asia might somehow be decoupled from the traumas were cast aside as it emerged that China's industrial production was actually falling. The National Australia Bank's measures of business confidence had recorded just massive falls. They were basically telling anybody who looked at the statistics of it that business was expecting a depression. All around the world, shoppers pulled back, retailers recording their worst season on record and laying off workers around globally by the millions. But not in Australia. When the ABS had finished tallying the December retail sales, they'd recorded the largest Christmas boost on record. True, many of the goods sold came from China rather than from the disappearing Australian manufacturing industry, but tens of thousands of retail, wholesale and transport employees kept their jobs in the New Year period. And this was repeated again in March-April, which really was the low point for the GFC. The government spending, much maligned spending, on construction on school building and public housing programs has also served to support employment as intended. Construction's typically the first industry to suffer in a downturn because development finance dries up immediately. In the 1991 recession, employment in construction dropped by 10%. And that result, which if replicated in 2009, would have meant 100,000 out of work from that industry alone. Non-residential commercial construction has indeed collapsed, with activity falling by 25% or, depending on which slices you look at it, more. But employment has held steady in the construction industry, largely because of the government stimulus spending. One of the problems when looking at whether government spending is effective or not is that there aren't ready counterfactuals. You can't say, well, what would it have been like if they hadn't? But Canada is an interesting example because it shared with Australia many of the same strengths that we had. Strong resource sector, banks not in trouble, and sound government finances going into the crisis. True, it has a 3,000 kilometre or so border with the United States, which had a problem or two, whereas we had neighbouring Asia. But a strength that it has, it always has a current account surplus, so it didn't have Australia's vulnerability to world financial markets. Well, its economy contracted by 2.6% in 2009, whereas ours grew by 1.3%. Canada's unemployment rate well over 8%. Another sort of example, which I think is an interesting way of looking at trying to assess the government's action, was given by Alan Kohler when doing a launch of our book in Melbourne. And he compares the experience in the latest downturn with the 1990-91-92 recession, which of course struck Australia very seriously indeed. He says that business saw that government was investing to keep the economy going in this time around, and it was prepared to keep staff on even if hours were reduced in the hope that the worst would soon be over. Whereas, by contrast, in 1991, when Paul Keating declared that this is the recession we had to have, business knew it was completely on its own and it cut accordingly. But the economy, when you look at it over the last 9 months or so, doesn't look like it's an economy that needs a great deal of stimulating. We've had unemployment falling pretty rapidly down to levels of around 5%, which by any benchmark are pretty much close to full employment. Business conditions are healthy. business investments going gangbusters thanks to the still continuing mining boom, and the Reserve Bank is clearly getting very close to shifting its stance from returning interest rates to a level that it might consider normal to one where it's actually trying to apply the brakes to the economy, slow the horse down. So, you know, I think that the health of the economy now is prima facie evidence that more was spent than was really needed to steady the economy. So how much too much? Well, Malcolm Turnbull's contention at the time of the February stimulus package, the $42 billion, was that it should have been more like $15 to $20 billion, rather than spending $14 billion on schools. About $3 billion, he suggested, was the most that the industry could absorb without giving rise to widespread rorting. I think those numbers sound pretty reasonable. It was a risk that the government knew it was taking. Wayne Swan is a pretty prosaic character who rarely impresses with his grace with language, but I liked the line that he gave to us, and he says, quote, "We were not hesitant, we were not meagre, we acted promptly, decisively, and in a big enough way to make a difference. The lesson of history is that governments have typically acted too timidly and too late in response to a downturn. We were determined not to repeat those mistakes." So what lessons would be drawn for the next crisis, which may, judging from any kind of casual read of the financial headlines, come rather sooner than we want? I think it's notable that around the world the pendulum is starting to swing against fiscal stimulus. In so many countries, the legacy of the downturn has been public debt burdens that shackle their futures. Some of the most compelling analysis of the financial crisis is based on accounts that of crises over the past century, and they contend that there will be sovereign defaults before this one is out. In his colourful time as shadow finance spokesman, Barnaby Joyce argued that this was in prospect for Australia, for which he earned a rare political rebuke from the Reserve Bank Governor Glenn Stevens. Australia's public finances are in great shape, despite the political rhetoric to the contrary. Our debt peaking at around $90 billion is little more than 6% of GDP. The OECD average is going to be closer to 100%. The government's borrowing on bond markets has zero influence on the short-term interest rate and no measurable impact on the long-term rates either, which are overwhelmingly determined by global capital markets. I have little doubt that if re-elected, the Labor government would return to the fiscal stimulus well if again confronted with an economic downturn. Both the government and Treasury deeply believe its interventions were a success. But the legacy next time could well be a more challenging debt, and potentially with a budget and structural deficit. I think one of the reasons why the stimulus was successful in Australia was because the crisis was relatively short-lived. It was enough to tide business over the worst period. It's less clear to me, at least, that it would work effectively in a more sustained downturn. That's the problem faced at present in both the United States and Europe. Stimulus programs are starting to wind down, subtracting from growth, but private sector demand is still weak. The policy trend is away from stimulus spending globally, so it's far from clear that world financial markets would look so kindly on stimulus spending of a similar scale with the global markets again in turmoil. And I think that, I guess my final conclusion is that the last war always provides misleading cues for the next battle. Thank you.
Thanks to Lenore Taylor and David Urim. We'll come to questions and discussion. Thanks also to Clayton Yutz for the use of this fine facility this evening. Just to either of you, in the previous recession, as you know, Peter Walsh was a pretty tough-minded economic minister in the Hawke government, and during the Howard government, which didn't experience a recession, but Peter Costello had a reputation of being pretty tough-minded in being against additional spending and favouring tax cuts instead. Was there anyone among the group of four senior ministers or anyone in the Treasury or in the Finance Department who might have made the case that perhaps the government was spending a bit too much?
There was, and he's just resigned. Lindsay Tanner emerged in most of our interviews as the sort of outlier in the kitchen cabinet group. The first stimulus package, the planning really began between Kevin Rudd and Wayne Swan, and without Julia Gillard and Lindsay Tanner really being involved, the very initial planning. By the time they were brought into the picture, Rudd and Swan had basically decided that they were going to go ahead with the stimulus package. Tanner took quite a lot of persuading, by all accounts. And then when it came round to the second stimulus package, he was the person within the kitchen cabinet arguing on the side of caution, arguing for lower spending. He says when we asked him about it, he sort of tried to downplay any sort of real divisions and said he was doing his job as a finance minister, and that's certainly probably part of it. But I think he was also, and also he was the guy that had just laboured to deliver savings in the first Labor budget, and to see the government then quite literally giving away cash was probably sort of came harder to him than to the others. But I think he also, from a policy point of view, was much less inclined towards the big spending package. He supported the stimulus, but he was always arguing for a lower number.
What about in the bureaucracy? Was there anyone?
Within Treasury, it was interesting that the sort of top level was really pretty united around the case for stimulus. Ken Henry, David Gruen, the head of macroeconomics, I think David Parker. The sense I get is that there was quite a large degree of unanimity at the secretary and deputy secretary level. Below that, there was a lot of concern. And I think also among, as I've heard it said, former Treasury secretaries and former senior Treasury officials. I think the story that came back to us was that it had been so hard grinding the budget back to a sustainable level of deficit, let alone surplus, in the wake of both the 80s recession and the 90s recession. You'd remember that in the 90s recession, at the very, very end of it, when it was far too late to be of any use whatsoever, there was a major stimulus package, the One Nation package, which was a sort of a crazy grab bag of promises. It's called the Glebe Island. The Glebe Bridge was part of that stimulus spending that all came on stream just as the economy was starting to grow at about 4%. But the pain of trying to cut was so difficult that there was some resistance internally within Treasury, but didn't get the impression at the level where the decisions were being made.
Thanks. So, there's a question. Yes. And I should say that we have copies of the book, Shitstorm, and I'm sure the authors would be happy to sign it, but talk to Janet Grundy. Anne.
Well, David, you mentioned that people were able to keep their jobs because employers were able to use the flexibility in the labour market to allow people to work some of the week and not others. This couldn't be done in the 90s because we didn't have the flexibility then, which meant that a lot of people put off their jobs. To what extent is the flexible labour market one of the success stories of how we got through it?
Look, I think it is the case. There's actually been a very interesting it's about a 300-page paper, and came last week, and I'd have to say I've only scratched it from the OECD, which is looking at that issue globally. I think that the rise of casual employment made a big difference. I think a lot of the adjustment on ours was just simply the cutting out of overtime. I think that there was, you get a lot of churn in the labour force. So I think one of the things that was happening was that people were losing jobs in full-time employment in other areas like service industries, which were kind of keeping on going reasonably well. Part-time jobs were being created. So that to some extent, the picture of very little rise in unemployment but a fall in hours is an amalgam of a lot of different things happening simultaneously. One point is the growth of temporary migration. I think that that was, you know, that was a really that was an important swing factor where instead of unemployment going up, skilled migration went down dramatically under the temporary 457 visas.
There's a question over there. Yes.
Yes.
Me?
Yes.
Okay. My name's Jocelyn Pixley, Macquarie University. I'm trying to look forward because obviously we're a bit, you know, we're now in election mode, okay? So you two have followed it. And I've got some...
Okay, can we just have a quick question or comment?
It's a quick question.
Okay, let's get on with it.
But it needs two points to be made. There's new data from Macquarie University looking by a very good colleague of mine at AES Data, which shows that the Liberlab Rusadon type support has declined. And what's very interesting is that a centre-right support has also declined rapidly, whereas a centre-left, which is sort of self, these are self-declared AES people, has risen. So it seems to me that what you're trying to look at is a decline in Labor on hard money grounds or something like that. But it's from what I'm hearing from, say, Lenore, particularly more in the recent work, is how would you analyse this decline of the centre-right and a rise in the centre-left?
Okay, right. This one allegation is a decline in the centre-right and a rise in the centre-left, and it's pretty authentic and has come from Macquarie University, I think that's
right. I haven't seen the research that you're referring to. I think that, it doesn't correlate with what I see or what I interpolate from the opinion polls, where the sort of base vote on either side, you know, when either the Coalition or the Labor Party are doing really, really badly, they always bottom out somewhere around 35% of the vote. That looks like, you know, their rock bottom base. And above that is the other swinging voters, the people who make up their minds on various issues or depending on who's leading the party at any given time. So I'm going to be interested to read the research that you're referring to, but I've got to say, that notion doesn't correlate with what I see in the opinion poll, so I'd be interested to sort of see what the hypothesis is.
I'd like to know your opinion on who was Kevin Rudd's primary economic advisor, whether it was in the bureaucracy, and like who did he rely on for his economic advice, and who did he go to when he was devising like a plan for the financial crisis, and what about Julia Gillard? Does she have someone that she goes to?
The question is, who was Kevin Rudd's principal economic advisor, and what about Julie Gillard's principal economic advisor?
Kevin Rudd had a remarkable relationship with Ken Henry. It was forged in the very first days of his prime ministership when the head of prime minister and cabinet at the time, Peter Shergold, who'd been Howard's head of PM&C, was seeing out his retirement notice period, and Ken was who Rudd turned to. So they hit off a very close relationship, and that was really paramount all the way through. About roughly halfway through, Rudd took on Andrew Charlton, who's a exceedingly bright, very young, you know, he was 28, 29 when he was hired, Doctor of Economics from Oxford University, awards for best thesis at Oxford, so done a lot of work with Stiglitz, former World Bank chief economist. So eminently well qualified, but not terribly experienced in the ways of the world. One of the, you know, as a little snippet, something I heard the other day was that it was he who was responsible for dubbing the mining tax the resource super profits tax. He thought it would play well. In terms of Julia Gillard, it's not entirely, it's not evident yet. She's got a good relationship with Henry. Frankly, I think Henry's likely to not renew his contract in when it comes due next April, but I'm not sure. Gillard has had quite a long and close relationship with the think tank Per Capita. So Tom Bentley, who's on the board of Per Capita, was her chief policy advisor. He's now working for John Brumby in Victoria. Wouldn't totally stun me to see him make a return, but there are quite a number of people associated with Per Capita who, some of whom are indeed on staff in the Prime Minister and Cabinet Department, such as Ben Rimmer and Subo Banerjee, who I think will be very influential on her in terms of economic policy.
Just to add, I just want to add one thing. Just to add one thing to that. Also, one of the prime, the, Kevin Rudd's former economic advisor, Stephen Kennedy, and this goes to the question of organisation of government process, has been appointed by Julia Gillard to the specific task of running business of government in her office. And I think that's quite, you know, quite an interesting thing for her to do, that she wants the processes of government, you know, to run smoothly, the relationship between her office and ministers and her office and the departments.
Lady in the middle there, we'll take a question. Yeah.
David, can I ask you a question? It's predictable that the government would expect, would say that their fiscal policy was successful in overcoming our problems with the DNC. But I would imagine that the Reserve Bank would have a slightly different take on it, that they'd be thinking that their monetary policy would have a pretty big effect as well, particularly given that we started such a high base with interest rates, and so they had a lot of meat to cut out.
Look, I think that's absolutely true, and clearly both were significant. But what I understand is that the Reserve Bank was indeed quite welcoming of the fiscal stimulus. One of the big legacy problems which central banks have around the world, but not in Australia, is dealing with the problem of zero interest rates. And the Reserve Bank was concerned that it could wind up in that territory. When interest rates are at zero, it becomes, you get quite perverse things happening with people's attitudes towards saving and spending, and it becomes much harder to get out of to sort of get back to a normal footing if you have to cut that far. So they were they were consulted as the fiscal stimulus was being planned, and were, as I understand it, pretty supportive.
Rory Robinson.
David, in your day job and also during the research, in the research of this book, you did have some good access to both the reserve, senior Reserve Bank people and senior Treasury people. What's your perception of those people? Would you rate them as, you know, in terms of quality and competence, were good, average, poor? You know,
that's pretty good, isn't it?
Look, I think they're exceedingly bright, you know, sort of a David Gruen at Treasury or a Philip Lowe at the Reserve Bank is, you know, they're both brilliant in, you know, in an intellectual sense. I think that Ken Henry was fairly, you know, he sort of had a strategic approach, I guess. Where I would have reservations, and I think I have them on both sides, really, and both Treasury and on the Reserve Bank, is really, I think that there's a bit of a scepticism about the sort of dirty commercial world. And hence, I think there's a distrust of some of the information that they get from the commercial world. So I think that, I mean, that was sort of blindingly manifest in Ken Henry's refusal to accept that a 40% tax on resource companies could possibly have any effect on their investment. But I also think that it was evident to some extent in how slow the Reserve Bank was in really appreciating the gravity of the financial crisis. And I guess I'm talking from kind of March, April, May, June, July, August, when from our research in the book, the government was taking that, was factoring it into its economic management and making really active contingency planning in a way that I don't believe the Reserve Bank was.
How would you rate economic commentators like Rory Robbins? Stunningly good.
Sheer genius.
Rachel, yeah.
Your thoughts on future Treasury finance ministers in an elected Gillard administration?
Reasonably comfortable in positing that Wayne Swan will be the Treasurer. In terms of finance minister, sort of Chris Bowen is I guess the man most likely. Some suggest that to make Chris Bowen also the minister for deregulation would be an oxymoron, but he's got a bit of an interventionist bent, but he's, I think, the outstanding emerging talent in the financial portfolios. I mean, arguably Crean could, it would be possible, plausible to make Crean finance minister and maybe give Bowen a bit more rounding in a more of a services portfolio like a health or education or something. I don't know, but I don't know whether you've got other thoughts on that.
No, I think Chris Bowen is making a big play.
The North thinks Chris Bowen. So, Craig. Yeah.
Obviously, the downfall of Wright happened extremely quickly. I'm wondering if you could expand on some of the insights in terms of timing of the interviews that you had, and you talked about Nelson's column, but like, can you maybe embellish some of the feedback you were getting? Was it a big surprise to you based on the process you went through?
And take us up to the book launch, because the former Prime Minister.
We did the interviews through the latter part of last year and early this year, and then we were sort of writing sort of up till about April. There was clearly disquiet with Kevin Rudd, absolutely, and ministers would kind of... They didn't voice it explicitly, but there was lots of anecdotes. I mean, things like people would say to us, well, all the public servants keep the paperwork until Kevin goes on holidays because Julia actually gets it done. And they would voice quite deep concerns about the fact that decisions were delayed and delayed and delayed until there was a crisis and it had to be made, and then it wasn't made in a particularly efficient or rational kind of a way. As for the actual night of the long knives, if you like, with the benefit of hindsight, knowing what I know now, there were some key players developing that as a contingency in the weeks before, but we certainly didn't know it at the time. And the sort of minor players that really precipitated the move on that night weren't necessarily working in Lee. It sort of happened a bit by accident. There was planning going on, but then it kind of developed by accident on the night, a confluence of events and the article in the Herald that upset Julia Gillard, the decisions by people to go and see her, the confluence of those events made it sort of happen organically. But it wasn't just that. Subsequently I've discovered that there were senior factional players planning for the contingency should they really come to the conclusion that it was untenable, which at about that point they did.
How did you find the Prime Minister at the launch?
Well, he was about an hour late. was a bit difficult to manage. But no, he was charming and personable, and he seemed quite relaxed and calm. He gave a very good speech, an interesting speech, and he didn't seem to... I mean, he obviously was a man under pressure, and they obviously knew that the potential was there at the time, but he didn't really give it away.
There's a question here.
Yeah. I'm Marshall Ahern. It seems to me that the emergence of the term trillion, mainly in the United States, in discussing the global financial crisis and intervention measures, has anaesthetised communities of the world to the impact of big numbers. So could you help us get our feet back on the ground? If we look at the Building the Education Revolution, a $16 billion program, and let's assume for the purpose of the discussion that 25% of it was wasted, $4 billion, where does it rank in the history of in the Western world of ministerial blunders?
I don't know that I would assume necessarily that 25% of it was wasted. I think... I think on the BER, I think really to a certain extent the jury is out in that in some states, some states seem to have administered the funding quite efficiently and quite well, and there seem to be relatively few complaints. Other states, like New South Wales, seem to have administered it less well, and there seem to be many complaints. And I think that when we get the verdict in, when we get the Orgel report or whatever reports come after that, because I'm sure that won't be the end of the line, I think what we'll find is varying degrees of maladministration by state bureaucracies and various degrees of pricing inflation because the government was simply trying to pump too much money into the construction sector in a very brief period of time. Personally, I reckon the insulation program was the biggest stuff up because, you know, that about two-thirds of the money went into putting bats in the roofs and the rest of it, you know, and a whole $4 billion went into trying to take them out again or test that the roofs weren't live. I mean, that's really, in terms of sheer complete maladministration, I would rank that number one for quite a while.
Anywhere else? Okay, we're not experts here on the world. There's a question down there and then there's one over here. Yep. Oh, one of you. Got a quick, yeah.
Do you see anything being done within the Labor government to remedy the lack of private sector experience, both in the members of the government and their bureaucratic advisers?
There is a commercial economist that works in the Treasury started to bring in a commercial economist to work in Treasury and give them sort of private sector advice, which I think is probably a good thing. In terms of Labor Party pre-selection processes, no, I don't see anything actually changing anytime soon.
Should the pressure be harder on the Cabinet for not acting as the government, which of course constitutionally they are, and standing up to the Prime Minister and making him report to them?
I think you have a point. I think we probably should have done more about that. It was difficult to really ascertain what was going on. The Cabinet themselves were loyal and particularly, and that was the point I was trying to make, but because it was a crisis, less likely to complain, less likely to leak. And it was a remarkably leak-free government when you consider what was going on, but I think you might have a point. We should probably have made more of it sooner in the government.
John.
Historically, treasurers have been the hard men of all the Liberal and Labor governments. But Swan doesn't seem to be the hard man. He's not the one who's always turning the screws on how we can justify programs. Do you see that role, if he continues as treasurer, as being a major problem? It seems all the ministers are quite keen to spend money on their programs. A lot of them are quite justifiable. But do you see that role is quite critical in getting Labor back to where it should be?
I do think that Lindsay Tanner played an important role and that his kind of eye and his inclination towards caution was important in the government before. I think that the Rudd office and the Swan office worked very closely together and had a kind of very similar policy objective. So unlike, say, Howard and Costello, whose offices worked very much apart, and that was quite a wake-up, quite a sort of revelation to the bureaucracy when the government changed, that, in fact, you know, they didn't have to kind of put a firewall between the Prime Minister's office and the Treasurer's office, that these guys actually got along. So I don't think Swan took that that traditional sort of hard man Treasurer role. I think that fell to Lindsay Tanner, and I think it probably is something that, you know, is a potential pitfall if Chris Bowen, who doesn't have a sort of a hard man kind of bone in his body either, takes on the Finance Minister's role. It's something that, you know, would probably, you know, could potentially be a problem.
Yeah, I'd probably quibble with suggestions. I'd quibble with suggestions that Peter Costello was a hard man. I think he oversaw some pretty extravagant spending in his later years.
So it's right up the back.
In Australia, we call it the GFC. When you go to the States or to Europe, they look at you blankly when you talk about the GFC. They don't use the term. How did we end up developing that term in Australia? And it's a totally different terminology overseas.
Sort of genius of Australian vernacular. I think they'd probably have, they'd probably struggle with the title of our book overseas as well.
Just a final question. How did you you two work together on this? I mean, you now are at different papers. You were at the same paper for some of the time, but how did you work together on this? And what do you think is the is the most significant bits of the new information in your book that that you got up with, that you came up with due to your interviews?
We did all of the big interviews together. Some of the chapters we researched separately, but most of the major thread of the book we researched together. We wrote the chapters separately, and then we spent a very long Christmas holiday writing the whole thing through at the beach house where I was supposed to be on holidays with my children, but in fact spent it locked in a room with a computer with David. And it was, you know, it was a good process. It worked quite well, I think, the co-authoring process. In terms of new information, I think there's all the way through bits of information that we didn't know before about when the government started planning, about when the Treasury started planning, about how the decisions were made. There's information in the book about the Liberal Party, which we haven't touched on tonight, but about all that turmoil in the Liberal Party under Brendan Nelson and Malcolm Turnbull. There's new information about the demise of Malcolm Turnbull and how that happened and the premeditation of that attack by Andrew Robb. So there's lots of pieces of new information through the book which really, you know, sets out, chronicles the history of that term of government.
Did you do it the same way that she did it?
No, look, I think certainly the book was a fine collaboration. I think that just a couple of the other bits that the book, I think, shines a light on really for the first time was just how close to disaster we came. There was a run developing on the banks in October 2008. Something we got from the Reserve Bank was that there was something like $5 billion withdrawn from banks in cash to be deposited, as a Reserve banker put it to me, in Mattress Bank. And a large amount of that's still there, but Suncor in Queensland, you know, I think came perilously close to collapse, and there were other worries as well. So I think that was one of the, you know, you kind of, as the economy burbles happily along now, it's easy to forget just what a, again, to quote the Prime Minister at the launch of that book, what a white-knuckle ride it was.
Many thanks, David. Take a seat. As I said, copies of the book are available. I'm sure the authors are happy to sign it. I will be very brief. We had recessions in Australia in the early 70s, early 80s, early 90s, and we didn't have a recession in 2008, but it was certainly a traumatic period in the history of Australian political economy. And it's great that two well-informed and well-connected journalists like Lenore Taylor and David Yaren were able to put the story together in a quick time and interview so many people and come up with both a book that explains what happened and a presentation tonight that gives life to the book. So well done to both of you. Thank you, and best wishes.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast.
This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.